This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Luc-Olivier Dumablet.
And I'm Yannick Marien.
And what's our topic this week, Yannick?
Free-to-play games.
Whoo! So before we start on that topic, I just want to mention that this week is kind of special.
Yeah, if you're hearing anything weird about the sound, it's because we are currently face-to-face.
Touching Yannick for a while for once.
Yeah, so we're face-to-face today in my basement, and it's been a long time since we've seen each other, so it's nice to see you in person.
It is.
Do you have any follow-up today?
I do have a small one that I already mentioned on Twitter over this week, and it is related to Taylor Swift.
Mm-hmm.
The small follow-up I have is I bought 1989. Hoo-hoo!
Congratulations, you succumbed to the temptation of Taylor Swift.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that it?
It is.
Okay, well, let's get into the main topic. I think this might be a record for the fastest we've actually gotten into the main topic.
Oh, wow.
Before we get too deep into the topic at hand, if you aren't a gamer, you may be tempted to stop listening to the episode. I would advise you not to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Don't do that.
This is a lot less about video games themselves and a lot more about the business models of those video games. And you can probably take some lessons from this that you can apply to your own software if you're an app developer. If you're not, well, I'm sorry, but listen to our show anyway. Also, this episode is about free-to-play games as they relate to adults, not to children. The business models become a lot darker and murkier when you talk about children and free-to-play games because they aren't necessarily aware of the value of money.
Yeah, let's just say that it's pretty easy to sell them stuff and make parents bought some stuff for them. And it's, yeah. I love the word that you use for that. Murkier.
Yeah. So 2014 was a year where many gamers that would identify as like hardcore gamers who never acknowledged free-to-play games as real games finally changed their mind on the subject. And I'm one of those gamers. There are, however, somehow still gamers who refuse to acknowledge smartphone games as real games. And I think there's very little hope left for those people. If you've watched the anime Sega Hard Girls, where Sega anthropomorphized Sega consoles actually live in the world amongst us, they've gotten over that too.
Wait a sec. Sega Hard Girls?
Yes. It's an anime series about the Genesis, about the Sega Saturn, and about the Dreamcast. And they enter the world of video games and complete various missions. And one of those missions involves them going into the Sega free-to-play game Chain Chronicle. And originally they look at the smartphone and they're like, I don't acknowledge this as a real gaming platform. And then they go into it and they discover that maybe it's not that bad. Sorry, I spoiled most of the episode.
Wow. Okay, why not?
So my hypothesis on free-to-play games is that most people who complain about them have no idea what they're talking about.
Wow, that's a nice hypothesis that we can apply on most topics that are spoken about on the internet.
Yeah, probably.
I'm even sure it can be applied to our podcast.
Probably, yes. So, unlike apps that are paid upfront, which have a clear cost structure, in-app purchase structure can vary from one game to the other and is very, very opaque from the outside. One might think that the top in-app purchase list would actually provide some insight to a newcomer to a certain app about what the in-app purchases are like. But most free-to-play games will actually force you to buy coins and then use those coins toward something. So it's very, very hard to tell what people are buying with those coins until you're in the app itself.
Yeah, and exactly. Like, if you go on the App Store and you go in the section, the top grossing one, I guess?
Yeah.
Because most of them will be in that section.
Yeah.
And you just go, like, you go in the app, and of course it will say get, because it's a free one. But now you scroll down and say, like, I think the sporting they use is, like, the most selling
in-app purchases.
Top in-app purchases.
Yeah.
And then you go in that list, and it's, like, 10 coin, 20 coin. Like, 100 coins.
500 coins for $100.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't really mean anything to the outside viewer. Do you actually know why they do this? There are two reasons. And don't look at the notes.
Yeah, I have to touch on... without looking at the note, what I will say is, when you're selling coins, most games that I play that are kind of free-to-play or, like, microtransaction-based are using, like, in-game credits. So maybe it's a way to go to progress in the game faster.
Not really. You're thinking probably of like Gran Turismo, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Mostly. So,
but most not only Gran Turismo, like most of the games that I have this concept of microtransaction is like you're a lazy person and you want the best car ever. You just give us more money and you get it.
Yeah, that works for like retail games on consoles. But when you come into free to play, that becomes a lot trickier because since it's free to play, you can technically bank a lot of those coins direct easily. So what they do instead is
say easily.
Well, yeah, but I mean, there's a reason they're called premium currencies. Premium currencies are currencies that you get from buying within app purchases or from events in a game, but you don't get them easily because they're scarce. That's the point of premium currencies. But there are reasons why they do this. The first one, of course, is it's to obscure the actual cost of things because you're buying coins up front and then you don't actually know at that time what you're going to be using those coins for. So then when they ask you, would you like to buy this upgrade for 200 coins? You don't actually know what that 200 coins cost you anymore because you already bought them a while ago. So that's the bad use of premium.
Obviously, and I'm sure nobody, including us, will do the calculation. Say like, oh, I bought 500 coins at 199, and that stuff is costing me 50 coins.
Well, the people who are a little bit geeky might do that, including myself. There's also a good reason for this, and I was aware of this year when I went to the arcade trade show JPO in Japan. They use coins because they can circumvent the in-app purchase approval process. You can get the coin pack approved once, and then you can use those coins towards anything. So you don't actually have to get individual in-app purchases approved.
So which is brilliant.
You can get away with a lot more. And this actually works out pretty well for music games in particular. That's why I actually found out about it. So in the beginning of the year, there was an update to Gitadora, which is the current version of Guitar Freak's Drummania, which, weirdly enough, has an iPad version.
Wait a sec. Guitar Freak's on the iPad?
Yeah.
Like, are you, like, strapping your iPad on yourself? And
you can, if you want.
Wow. Okay.
But, they updated the app to have new songs every day. But they couldn't get new songs every day if they had to get every in-app purchase approved. So what they did is they changed to a coin-based model, and then they could add new songs every day. So that's a good use of it. I wouldn't say it's the prevailing use, however.
And also, I'm, like, 90% sure that it's only on iOS. Like, if you go on the Google Play Store, I don't think there's any approval process for in-app purchases.
It's possible, but since iPhone is such a dominating part of course, people of who course. Pay for apps, it sort of works for that. So this episode is actually kind of special because it's not really... I'm not going to be trying to make the case for free-to-play games. What I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be talking about notable and interesting free-to-play games that I have played or have experience with. And it wouldn't be a free-to-play episode if I didn't mention Puzzle & Dragons. So, you looked at the list of games that I was going to talk about, and this is apparently the only one you've ever heard of. And you weren't even sure you had heard of it.
Yeah, no, I heard from it a little bit, and I'm sure it was from you. And I know it's kind of Bejeweled-like.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that now Bejeweled is free to play. So I was like assuming
the
same.
Yeah, there's free to play Bejeweled. You should ask my mom about it upstairs.
So I heard of it. Maybe like, is there a like Facebook app version of it?
I don't think so.
Ah, okay. Never mind then.
Gung Ho, which develops this game, calls it puzzle action with RPG elements, which is very vague and meaningless. It's Bejeweled, except you can slide jewels around the entire board instead of only adjacent slots.
Oh my god.
But of course, you need to balance this, because otherwise you can just, like, you spend 15 minutes making the entire board combo. So what they do is, from the second you actually touch the jewel in question, there's a time limit, and you have to do it very quickly within that time limit. There's a little hourglass on top of your finger when you're dragging to let you know how much time you have left.
And what's the average time limit when you do that?
I'm not sure. I think there are actually creatures you can get in the game that can expand it, but I'm not entirely sure about
that.
So optimally, you need to think through your entire trajectory across the board before you touch it, because that gives you more time to think than if you touch and then start to think and then you screw up your combo.
But is there any like global time clock? Because I guess if you just wait and do your math and do your calculation to move this piece at that place and that piece at that other place without any time limit, it's going to be still easy.
You can't really think about it like that because, I mean, like, you can look at the board and you can say, okay, I'm going to make, like, four combos, and then new pieces are going to drop from the top, so you can't actually know what those are yet and how those will influence your trajectory.
Yeah. But I'm sure there's still, like, a chess element to that. Like, you can predict certain stuff.
Yeah.
Not the new pieces, but at least certain pieces that you'll be able to do some
combo. If you go look up videos, it always, like, shocks me when I'm on Twitch and I see people that are streaming Puzzle and Dragons because that's, like, streaming Bejeweled. Like, what the hell are you doing?
They are streaming that? Oh,
but
that's nice.
They exist. And looking at high-level Puzzle and Dragons play, which, again, I'm sort of weirded out by the fact that I'm saying these words, but it's insane. You have no idea how they're doing those combos really fast. And, like, you can see the time they take between, like, when the jewels drop and when they take their next move, and it's not that long, and they make crazy-ass combos.
Hmm. So, I guess I'll have something to watch after the podcast.
Yeah. So it's one of the big smartphone free-to-play success stories, one of the first big ones. It has estimated daily revenue of 2 to 3.5 million US dollars.
I guess we're not making the right apps.
No, I guess we should be making Yo and Puzzle and Dragons and merging them together into Yo and Dragons.
You know what? The concept of that app will be you have tons of Yos of different colors on your board.
Yeah.
And you need to yell Yo and the color in your iPad microphone. And then, I don't know.
And then it spams all your friends with push notifications
that
just say Yo and then the color.
Whatever.
That sounds like a winning strategy. Hey, if Yo was able to get a million, we can almost get like twice that. Most free-to-play games coming out of Japan, but also all over the world, are trying to emulate Puzzle and Dragons. In fact, Sega's had better days, but these days they've actually released an exact clone of Puzzle and Dragons called Puyo Puyo Quest, which is exactly the same, except that it features the cute characters of Puyo Puyo, instead of the
Dragons.
Puzzle and Dragons, yeah. It's really embarrassing. And they have an arcade version of it, which is arcade free-to-play, which is even more strange, but it works.
Arcade free-to-play?
Well, it would take a long time to explain this, but it's very, very useful if you've been walking all day, that you can just, like, walk up to a Puyo Puyo Quest machine and then play for, like, 15 minutes and then get off and rest your feet. Yeah, you can play about 15 minutes for free. And it recharges in about, like, 3 hours. So you can, like, go about your day and then go into the arcade and play Puyo Quest for 15 minutes to rest your feet. And I have no idea how they're making money.
Because that sounds awesome.
It is. It's very, very useful. It lets you kill time without spending any money. So here are some elements of gameplay that are recurring in many, many free-to-play games that you'll probably hear about if you talk about any other free-to-play game. I need to go over these because they will apply in other games that we're going to talk about. One of them is stamina. Stamina is a gauge that you have in the top of the screen that tells you how much you can play and how long you have until you can next play. Lets you control how much you can play in a given period of time. Now, what's interesting about stamina is a lot of free-to-play games, not all of them, but Puzzle and Dragons is one of them, are what people would categorize as casual games that you would play in line at a place. And for people who are playing Puzzle and Dragons between doing things throughout the day, they might never actually run against the stamina wall. So for them, free-to-play is really, literally free-to-play. Like, they can have other reasons on the side to spend for money, but the actual act of playing never actually requires them to spend money, which is interesting.
And I honestly think that the most free-to-play games I played, I will fail into that category.
Of people who never run up against the limit?
Yeah, I guess some of them I will run up against the limit, but most of them I was like, oh, just trying it for maybe 30 minutes, run against the limit, and then try maybe twice or thrice more in the next coming days, and even then I was just playing casually, like 5-10 minutes.
Well, it's strange that you'd mention like running against the limit right when you start the game, because actually that is when you're least likely to hit the limit, because games are actually programmed so that you can play for the first time like maybe 3 hours in a row uninterrupted, because when you level up your character, your stamina gauge refills entirely. And not all games are like that,
no,
but some are.
Because the last one I played was some weird... You were a cashier, and it was a Vita. It was on the PS Vita, and it was like this. You had X amount of coffees, which is funny. And then you can use coffees as lives.
Yeah, yeah.
And then at some point you run out of coffee for at least 30 or 1 hour. 30 yeah. minutes or 1 hour.
Yeah, that's about what it is normally. But when you have a leveling mechanism, which a couple of games do have, then they can actually like string you along and say, okay, you started the game. If you keep playing, you can play for like 3 hours uninterrupted. And we're going to come back to that notion a little later with another game. The next element is the mashup of a collectible card game and another genre. And this is the one that pisses me off the most. It's tolerable in games like Puzzle and Dragons.
There's collectible card games on Puzzle and Dragons?
Well, so it's sort of like, I call it a collectible card game because it's the closest analog in real life. But every monster you get is in an egg, which is random. So you collect them like that. And then they have an elemental type, and they have stats, and they have all that stuff. So it's sort of like Pokemon in a way.
Okay.
And you can level up your cards by collecting multiple of them and putting them into, like, if you have, like, six of the same, like, red dragon, you can actually use those five extras you have and use them to increase the experience points on your first one. And then after a certain point, they can evolve. And there are huge, complicated evolution chains. And I just get lost in all that stuff.
And all of that for a Bejeweled game?
Yeah.
Oh my god.
But okay. It's contaminating like a bunch of other game genres doing this. Because this is one of the ways that Puzzle and Dragons makes money is you can, and that was actually the next mechanic on my list, is the gacha. So gacha, one, it actually sounds like gotcha, but it comes from gachapon, which is the if you've seen gumball machines where you like turn the gumball thing and you have a plastic egg and you have a toy inside. Well, there are gacha machines inside of Puzzle and Dragons, and there are multiple kinds of them. Normally it costs about, like, for the best one, it costs $5 to draw one egg out of the machine.
But when you say $5, it's like
five real dollars.
What?
And you get one creature out of it.
Oh my. Okay. I can understand now that why they are aware of making tons of millions
but
per day.
But it's guaranteed to be the highest rarity. Like, there is a pool of ultra high rarity. If you want the ultra high rarity only machine, you pay $5.
Oh wow, okay. And there's no other way to get those except
Get them, but random drops from dungeons. And there are some of them that are only accessible from that. Now, if that sounds insulting to you, if only you knew how bad it was before 2012. Because before 2012, there was this thing called Kompu Gacha, which is a Japanese word which means complete gacha. And complete gacha means you had to collect entire series of gacha drops. And then with that entire series, you would get an even bigger bonus. So you would be compelled to spend a bunch of money on gacha drops. And then once you had collected, like, all of the striped dragon set, then if you had every single card in that set, you could get an extra powerful striped dragon out of that. So it would incentivize people to spend thousands and thousands of dollars to draw stuff.
We are honestly not in the right business.
I know. But Kompu Gacha was banned in Japan in 2012. I believe this was like the fastest time ever that someone actually regulated this thing. They said, like, it makes no sense. People are spending thousands of dollars on these stupid virtual things. And of course, when the game shuts down eventually, because there's no guarantee that the game is going to live forever, all the money you spent is gone, basically. Yeah. There is no way to redeem that investment in anything else.
It's like, let's say it's a nice way to throw money out of the window.
Right. So, I should be clear, Puzzle and Dragons never actually did Kompu Gacha. It's just a derivative of the gacha that is very popular in those kinds of games. There's also inventory and friend list limitations, which are frustrating sometimes. Inventory meaning you can only have 25 creatures in your Puzzle and Dragons set. If you have more than 25, you have to throw them out or sell them or use them, merge them into other creatures or stuff like that. But you can't keep more than 25. If you want to have more than 25, you can buy 5 additional slots for X amount of energy orbs or whatever it's called. Friend list is the same way. In many of these games, friends are used as an additional slot. So you have a team of 5 creatures of your own, and you can have a 6th creature, which is your friend's thing. And friends have a higher damage output, I believe, than strangers. So if you want to have more friendless slots, you can actually pay to increase those as well. Now let's get into how Puzzle and Dragons actually makes so much profit. It's because it's a lean and mean free-to-play game. It was developed with the goal of being as inexpensive to maintain as possible. And, I mean, like, in Pokemon, what's great about that game is there are Pokemon that is similar to other Pokemon in other elemental types. For example, Charmander is the fire starter in the first series, and Squirtle is the starter, and they have similar specs, more or less, except they're different elemental types. Well, in Puzzle and Dragons, they just draw one dragon and then change the color, and it's the same across all of the things. They don't even bother drawing the other ones. They're like, hue and saturation is how we make more characters. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but for the base monsters, the ones that are not ultra rare rarity, that's more or less what it is.
I do hope that they hiring a good designer if they want to charge you $5 for these ultra rare ones.
The ultra rare art is actually very, very good, and occasionally they'll bring in like guest artists that are very popular from the manga world or whatever, and get them to do limited edition things that, of course, you have to spend thousands of dollars to try and get afterwards. But I mean, it works. So yeah, rampant asset reuse under the guise of elemental types. And lean and mean is a fine strategy to maximize how much money you make out of a free-to-play game, but it's not the facet of free-to-play that I find most interesting. Puzzle and Dragons could easily be an entire show on its own. In fact, there are entire shows about Puzzle and Dragons, believe it or not. So I don't want to dwell too much on it. One thing that I forgot to mention earlier is that Puzzle & Dragons, what's really special about that game is how much, and this is going to sound ridiculous if you hate free-to-play games, but the game respects its players and is incredibly generous with how much free stuff they give you. They did lots of market research, and they tried being hyper-aggressive and playing psychological mind games with people, and they said, well, first of all, if you try to force people to pay all the time, they are more likely to quit. So if you give them free stuff, they'll stay longer, and if they stay longer, they have more attachment to the game, more likely to pay for the game. And they just respect that they know not everyone's going to play, and the game is entirely playable, as far as I know, free-to-play doing the thing. It's just if you actually want to maximize your stats and go out and get the super cute girl cards and everything, then you maybe have to spend some money to do it. And something I forgot to mention is I said collectible card game earlier and not trading card game, because you can't trade these, because that would ruin the entire point. And there would be entire black markets of cards and stuff like that. And that is not what Gung Ho wants if they want to make money. So people
Since those cards are like digital one, it's kind of easy to not make them tradable.
Yeah.
It is really
easy. Just remove a menu option, or you never code the menu option exactly. In the first place.
But it's pretty interesting the fact that they are, like, we all have bad experiences with free-to-play games that are trying to, get all of your money. And well, it's pretty interesting that they put, like, so much effort, and maybe it's part of the initial design of the game that it should be not easily available to play freely without spending any money, but the option is still there, and they're still thinking about that.
Yeah.
In a way.
They are entirely conscious that the majority of their players are never going to spend a dime, and so it's not in their interest that they hit a wall. Because if they were never going to pay to begin with, then why are you blocking them from the rest of the content? They're just going to switch games. So if you can keep them in your game that way, and some people can see that as like entrapment or trying to keep them in the thing, but like if there's a game you generally enjoy and you hit a wall, it's going to turn you off, whereas if there's no wall, well, you're more likely to keep going, and that's just how things go.
And if the game maker is lucky enough, at some point you'll just jump over the fence and start paying.
Yeah, and all of the mechanics that I mentioned earlier that Puzzle and Dragons either pioneered or just made very, very popular, people will copy those mechanics, but they won't copy the generosity and things, because that's hard math that you have to do to try and figure out what the right balance of things are. And you have to think about people's emotions, and developers, God knows, aren't very good at that. Please send email to no one.
to Yannick.
But yeah, so if you're more interested in Puzzle and Dragons and knowing exactly how they balance the game and design the game in intricate details, there are a bunch of links in the show notes. The show notes this week are nuts. There's Mikhail Katkov, which wrote a piece for Gamma Sutra deconstructing the entire game design, and Kazuki Morishita, which is the lead on Puzzle & Dragons, gave a post-mortem talk at GDC, Game Developers Conference 2014, which is also incredibly enlightening, and they go into some of that ethical boundary stuff and being respectful of your users and all of that stuff, and it's very, very entertaining. So that's it for Puzzle & Dragons. Do you have anything to add? Nope.
That's good.
Okay, now all the music gamers that are listening to this are going to get very excited because I'm going to talk about Crossbeats.
And that's my cue to go.
Everyone who doesn't care about music games is fleeing from the room right now. So before I get into Crossbeats, I need to explain the context of 2014 in the world of music games, because it's sort of a big year in the world of music games, and I don't think many people realize this because A, they either don't care about music games, or B, they have their heads in their asses. So this year in 2014, guess how many arcades closed down? Don't look at the page.
I cannot guess. I saw the number now.
Okay,
but let's say like 10.
No. It's actually 135 arcades closed in Japan in 2014. Now, 135 arcades, that sounds like probably the amount of arcades there are in the entire country of Canada right now, which is very sad.
No, I would say that's the number of arcades that was 10 years ago in Canada.
That sounds about right. But 135 arcades, to put that in perspective, one of the largest arcade chains in Japan is called Round One, and they have 113 arcades across the entire country of Japan. 135 is only the number of arcades that carried music games, because those are the only ones I care about. But that is actually how many shut down in Japan in 2014, which is nuts. It's terrifying for people in the arcade gaming industry. On top of that, the attendance to Japan Amusement Expo, which is the yearly trade show for people in the arcade business, attendance was down by half, which is shocking. I should also point out that there was crazy weather that day, so that might also be responsible for it, but there was certainly a drop. It was noticeable. The floor was empty.
I guess we'll be able to report on that this year.
Yeah, because I'm going back in a couple months. And it seems inevitable to me, maybe not to others, but to me, that arcade gaming is going to fade very, very quickly, and that makes me worried about where music gaming is going to go. And, go ahead.
Yeah, and on that point, I would say that it will happen, because it happened here. Like, I know that our, like, arcade culture was really big, like, 15 years ago?
In the 80s here.
Yeah, but let's just say that it was still big in the 90s and the beginning of the 2000s, but it started to fade at the beginning of the 2000s.
Well, home consoles had a much bigger impact here than they did in Japan, I would say.
Yeah, and most of the game in the arcade was like ports or some kind of version from the home consoles. So yeah, and then like maybe it won't have the same effect or the same effect as fast as it was here, but I'm sure it will. Like,
well, the thing that has actually killed arcade gaming in Japan is not home consoles.
No, I'm not saying it will be the same.
It's free to play games on your phone.
Oh, but I was not saying that it will be console. I was just saying that something will replace those arcades, like something did here.
Yeah. And so my guess, obviously, it shouldn't be no surprise, is that they're going to go to free-to-play smartphone and tablet games. And I want to take a brief tour of free-to-play music games. There aren't very many of them, so it's not going to take very long. There's Your Love Live, which is biggest mobile music game, sadly, in the world, I would imagine.
Sadly.
There's also Tokyo 7 Sisters, which is basically a clone of Love Live. Both of these games, they are ruined music games, because whether or not you are actually good at the music game does not matter to the ultimate goal of the game.
So I would like those music games.
No. Oh. Because in those games, instead of actually caring about whether or not you're good at music games, what is important is the stats of your idols in your idol group, which brings me back to the collectible card game bullshit that Puzzle & Dragons does. Which means that if you don't care for that particular mechanic, the Love Live game is completely worthless to you. And it sucks, because I really like the Love Live songs, except I can't play that game because I have to level up stats on little girls, and I don't care about that shit.
Okay.
There's also Tic Tac Concerto, which you have probably never heard of because it's an indie free-to-play game, which is incredibly rare, actually, to see independent developers risk their stuff with free-to-play games. That game is actually very, very interesting because the gacha mechanism in that game is used to get you basically get the cover of the album for the song that you unlock. And if you collect three of one, you can upgrade that to a silver chart and a gold chart. So you get higher difficulties by collecting more of them. And it's very, very generous in how you can get those songs. The disappointing thing is it's very visibly an indie game. The music quality is very bad. The visual quality is very bad. But it's interesting from a systems point of view. There are also song pack games. These are, of course, the ones that Konami sells. So there's UBeat Plus, there's Reflect Beat Plus, there's Gitadora, which I mentioned earlier. These are basically home ports of arcade titles, which is why they can get away with it. They are just making money off of songs that already exist in the arcade, so they can just bring them to the home version and basically spend very little money maintaining those versions.
I guess the only money they need to invest is in making the engine work on iOS, for example.
Right, exactly. So that's basically the entire scene of free-to-play music games, excluding Crossbeats right now on iOS. There are probably a few that I haven't heard of, but more or less, it falls into those categories. And
those games are currently available as free-to-play music games on smartphones?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. I thought it was...
And Love Live is available internationally because it's a popular anime series that all over the world, whereas the rest of them are only available in Japan. Those music games, well, the home versions of Konami arcade games, those are appealing to me, but they're appealing to me because I play the arcade version. The Love Lives and everything, I don't like those because I don't like to spend all my time thinking about stats on little girls. I would rather just play the damn game.
Please stop saying that. Honestly, please stop saying that.
The episode title is going to be Stats on Little Girls. And
no, it's more thinking about stats on little girls.
And Tic Tac, as I mentioned, the production quality just isn't up to what I'm used to. So then Crossbeats comes along, and the community reaction to that is actually very, very troublesome. So Crossbeats is a game by Capcom, which is responsible for lots of games like Street Fighter and Mega Man and all that stuff before they killed off Mega Man. It's produced by Naoki Maeda, which, if that name sounds familiar, it's because he actually was responsible for Dance Dance Revolution at Konami for very many years. And DDR, you've probably heard of.
Until that game fade away in some...
Yeah, until music games died in the West.
Yeah, but DDR was from the East?
No, DDR was by Konami. It's a Japanese game.
Yeah.
But it was available here. Well, not officially, maybe, but whatever.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to say here is that game still popular in Japan? Or it also fade away in Japan? It did fade away here, well, but it was the popular Japanese
still,
music games.
There are still yearly arcade releases of DDR. Like, right now it's called DDR 2014. But Konami clearly doesn't give a shit. They're only taking songs that from the American versions of the games and porting them to the arcade and, like, pretending that they're new songs, but they're not new songs. And they're very much in maintenance mode with the game, where they're keeping it alive because people are still playing it, but they clearly do not give a shit.
Oh, that's a little bit sad.
Yeah, it's really sad for those people because, like, at Polyphonic Room, every time we post, like, DDR 2014, there's a new song today. Well, we know deep inside that it's not a new song. It's been out there for, like, 5 years already. It's never been in the arcade. So back to Crossbeats. Crossbeats is stamina-based. You get 10 stamina points. They are called regular tickets, we'll say. And you recover 5 points every hour in 10 minutes. I'm familiar with these numbers because I play it a lot, optimizing to play as much as possible throughout the day. If you actually choose to pay for premium tickets, which are what you use to pay for songs, it comes out to 100 yen per 3 songs, which is more or less on par with arcade pricing. And this brings me to a lot of the time you hear people talk about free-to-play games, and they say free-to-play games is just like the arcade repeated on your home on your tablet. And most of the time, that's not true.
But why somebody would say that? Because arcades were not free-to-play.
Well, they weren't. No, very few arcade games will let you play for free. But I mean, free-to-play games entice people to pay so much for games.
Insert a clip of me playing Time Crisis 3 on an arcade and seeing my money fly away from my pockets. Yeah. Oh man, that game. I don't
So what's interesting about CrossBeats is it has incredibly high production values. In fact, it's Capcom's first real music game, and I say that because they also had Otoranger, which is another game that they did a few months before that. And that was a music game, but it was a lot more like the Love Lives and whatever. They had boring stat stuff ruining the game. But CrossBeats, it's like the first Capcom music game, but it's high tier. It's like better than most of the stuff Konami has released this year, which is insane because Konami is the music game company. But it's incredibly poorly received in the music gaming community because of its business model, which is sad because it's a great game. And the two things that I hear most often about it are, I would pay $30 for the full version, in quotes, of this game instead, or has anyone managed to hack CrossBeats so you don't have to pay anymore? Which is a whole other problem. And that brings up, of course, price elasticity. So price elasticity, you can go look it up on Wikipedia, and I should probably put a link in the show notes. How many sales in the addressable market are lost due to a high price point? Would setting the price point lower bring in more money? And is this money enough to sustain the quality you wish to deliver with your product? And I strongly believe that if CrossBeats was paid up front, it wouldn't be able to sustain the production quality that it has today. It's also very much like the arcade because, there's a system in the arcade, specifically for Konami games called e-amusement participation, where, Konami will sell the arcade cabinets at cost to the arcades, and then they take a percentage, I believe it's 30%, of each transaction that is made on that arcade machine. So they can actually sustain the game longer term than if they sold the cabinet for $7,000 up front and then you never got another penny again. So the free-to-play mentality has basically come to the arcade instead of the other way around, which is strange. One of the things that people forget when they ask for the $30 finished game version of the product is that CrossBeats gets new songs every week. And a finished product that you pay $30 for, or all the PlayStation versions of DDR that I have over there, they don't get new songs every week. It would be great if they did. They don't.
But but you're touching a point here. Like, most of the American music games that they are currently selling are using that mantra. So you buy the game $60,
yeah,
and you have 20 songs.
Yeah.
But the digital store is full of the new pop music, like the new Taylor Swift album and all that stuff, to make you buy those songs.
Yeah.
And why that business model won't work, according to your findings?
Well, it could work, except then people aren't going to pay for all the packs. Most of them aren't. Like I mentioned earlier, there are some games that Konami sells where that is the only way to get new songs. Like, you get the game for free and you have like 3 songs to see if you like the game, basically. And then every song from every previous version of the arcade game is available for purchase, and there are packs every month that you had added. So that works.
But in that case, I wouldn't say it's a free-to-play game. It's more a demo version of it.
Right. But the problem is that they can charge like the $4 they charge for the pack because they already made those songs and paid for them in the arcade. So they can charge, it's free money for them, basically.
Oh, okay, see. Like, all the investment money to design those songs and all that shit is already made.
If your game is entirely mobile, then you can't do that because you have to actually pay for the songs you're adding. You see what I mean?
Now I see it. Okay.
So let's get into how CrossBeats, how you can unlock songs in CrossBeats and also how they make the most money. It's a good friend that we have called Random Select Festival, and this will either make you want to cry and run away or put glee on your face. Let me explain this beautiful system. And by beautiful, I mean it's sort of a piece of shit. Once a month, every week, once a month for a week, the random button on the song select screen turns into a festival button. And yay, festive. We love festive. It's great. What that means is you have an X percent chance, and that X percent is undetermined, of getting an unlock challenge for a song you don't have, which is great.
So, but that's pretty neat.
Wait a sec.
See, I haven't read the show notes.
Yeah, so when you get an unlocked challenge, that does not mean you've unlocked it. It means you can challenge the song to unlock it.
Oh, so you need to pass the song.
No, not only that, you have to pass with certain criteria. And depending on the song and difficulty, these can be very, very, very difficult. If you want to try and get it from the get-go, by default, when you do the festival button, if you get an unlock challenge, you're going to get like the second highest one. So you have to try and get that. But then, because like the criteria, you have like five tiers of criteria, and you can select which one depending on difficulty, and it contributes points towards the unlock.
Okay, I see.
So you can actually unlock half a song and then get another unlock challenge for that song and get the remaining half by doing lower tier things. But if you want to unlock the entire song at once, usually it's going to be like full combo of the song if you want to get it in one try, which I can do with like basic charts, the easiest difficulty, but I can't do that with the hard ones.
So like the normal case that will happen is
you'll get the unlock challenge with the second highest. So normally, in most cases, you'd have to do that twice in a row to unlock the full song.
But now you will be forced to do more than twice because it is mostly sure that you won't attain that level.
And... Well, it depends how good you are. Okay. Some of my friends can actually like get it on the first try. But like in my case, I have sometimes spent like days trying to unlock challenge certain songs. And yeah. And don't forget that if you are playing entirely free to play, you can only play two songs in a row. When your gauge is full, you can only play two songs in a row. After that, you have to wait to regen.
Okay.
So if you get an unlock challenge on your second try, you can't actually get it without paying. That's one thing.
Because like the delay that will make your gauge to refill.
Well, not just that. Even if you like get the perfect, the highest criteria on the song, by default, when you get an unlock challenge, it takes the second highest. And even if you get the high one, it brings it down to that level. So you have to do that one twice. But you only had one song left in your gauge, so you played it. So then you have zero gauge, so you can't do anything unless you pay.
Or wait.
Well, yeah, but you can't wait because the unlock challenge only lasts for 20 minutes, I think.
Aha!
See what I mean? It's complicated.
The delay to refill the gauge is big.
If you get an unlock challenge, you probably aren't going to get an unlock challenge.
Yeah, and let's be honest, the percentage is like winning the lottery, you know?
It's higher than that.
Maybe the chance to win something at the lottery.
And the thing is, it's not actually determined. Some of us have tried to, like, figure out more or less what it is. It appears to be higher if you have a higher backlog of songs you don't have. So, like, if you have most of the songs unlocked, you will have a lower chance of getting it than if you have lots of songs you don't have unlocked. Because, like, if you have, like, three songs unlocked and you want to unlock more songs, obviously you're going to want drops sooner than...
Yeah, it is to incentivize people that
to keep playing, right?
Yeah, to keep playing.
So... coincidentally, today there was a random select festival that began with a new song called Dekatsuki, which is unlockable. And someone in our community, which I won't name, spent $213 trying to unlock it. That's 640 songs. And this is only for one unlock in one event, for one difficulty. Though now that he has one difficulty unlock, he can unlock the other two freely as he wants.
I honestly have one question.
Yes.
How much was it to unlock that song? If you want to just pay and unlock that song.
You can't.
What?
No.
What?
No. So, Random Select Festival has, like, two kinds of songs, really. There are Random Select Exclusives, which, of course, you can only get, like, that one, Akatsuki. It was only available for Random Select. And after, like, 6 months, there's going to be, like, 1 week where you can buy it if you have enough LE, which is another premium currency, stocked up. If you haven't, no, it's not LE. It's the other one. SP, I think. Anyway, there are multiple premium currencies, and you can use one of them to purchase songs during that week when the Ransai song is for sale in the store. It's a complex system. It's messed up. Now, let's compare this to Beatmania 2DX. I'm thinking specifically here of the Omega Attack unlock event in Tricoro Blue. That lasted about 80 credits, so $80, and you unlocked 8 songs. So that's actually, like, that's normal for arcade games, for arcade music games. That's normal.
Yeah.
213 songs for one difficulty of a song. Like, at least in 2DX, you were getting 8 songs in all difficulties. So even if the game was entirely free, though, there's the other problem, which is that this unlock system is bullshit, because no one wants to play 640 songs before actually getting the one you wanted.
Wait, you need to play 640 random songs?
Yeah, that $213 amounts to 640 songs that you have to play randomly. In a row to unlock that song, because when you get it, you have to play the song, and then once you're done that song, you can roll again, and then you can get another song, and if it's the one that you want, then you get it, but if it's not, then you have to keep playing, and you have to play 640 songs. Well, it might not be 640 because it's random. It could be more, it could be less, but that is an example from today, taken from Twitter, 640 songs to get it. And occasionally, you will see Crossbeat players on Twitter listing every song they play in a row. To try and figure out, because one time someone actually did that and they found the RNG seed for the game, and they could actually recreate the RNG seed correctly every single time and get the song in like 5 tries, which it was great for like the week it happened, and then they patched it and everyone was sad.
Oh man. It's like hacking casino machines in the 80s and 90s.
So I could go on about Crossbeats, but I won't, because it would just depress everyone. But
yeah, and
that is the primary reason that it has a bad reputation in the community. And I sort of understand it, but at the same time, the game is so good, I don't care. There are other songs to unlock, and there are other ways to unlock them than that, except there are certain songs that are exclusive to that, and that pisses everyone off, and it's the good ones.
Exactly. I was about to say that. I'm sure that it's the one you want.
Always.
I'm sure it's the one you want.
Okay, so let's change gears a bit and let's talk about Phantasy Star Online 2.
Before we start.
Yes.
Am I able to not be pissed about that game? Or I'm going to be pissed about it.
It's a really good game, man.
So I think that's a yes.
It's a really good game, but you have to not pay attention to that event specifically. The other events are fine, but that event specifically pisses everyone off.
And okay, so you take the worst one.
Yes,
I did. And you're going to talk about that one.
That's the one that makes the most money. Like, the other ones, you can actually get the song unlocks for free if you try hard enough, and I get them most of the time. So that's how they make their money. I mean, it has to be, because there's no other way. Phantasy Star Online 2, everyone. as you can probably guess from the 2 in the title, it's the sequel to Phantasy Star Online, which was a game that Sega released in the 90s on the Dreamcast.
You know what? I wouldn't guess.
Okay, but now I'm going to also tell you that it's not Phantasy Star Online 2 ES, which is a completely different game. And it is a smartphone game, whereas Phantasy Star Online 2 is on Vita and on PC. It's an MMORPG, which means massively multiplayer online role-playing game, which basically doesn't mean anything because almost everything is an MMORPG now. And back in the old days, MMOs were more or less, they made their money by monthly subscription fees. In fact, I believe World of Warcraft still does. But at a certain point, especially in Asia, free-to-play became the norm for MMORPGs. And the main reason for this is MMOs are meant to be played with other people, and there's no easier way to get more people involved than if you tell them, hey, go download this game. It's free! Asterisk. Get.
You forgot one thing. Includes in-app purchases.
Includes in-app purchases, yeah. One important distinction, there are certain MMOs which people called pay to win, which is pretty obvious. It means that you can't actually... The content in the game is built supposing that you've already purchased certain items from the so it's, they're impossible if you don't have the paid items.
Oh no, I
don't. Which games. Capcom Online games. Yeah, don't play their MMORPGs.
Pay to win.
Yeah. Pay to win. There was actually, like, I don't remember which game it was. I believe it was one of the Soul Calibur free-to-play games on PlayStation that they accidentally, like, the Namco.
Accidentally?
Yeah, the Namco rep was talking to press, and they said, oh, yeah, we're working on a pay-to-win game. And then they were like, oops. No, we didn't say that.
At least they are being honest.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it's not pay to win. What it is that all microtransactions in PSO2 are things that would be nice to have, but are ultimately unneeded to progress in the game. And I am serious when I say this because I played the game for 250 plus hours and I reached basically level cap. So you can do it. It's possible.
Freely.
Freely.
Okay.
I paid 1 month for the premium thing because I actually wanted the perks that it had, but even without it, I would have gotten there anyway.
But and then, even if you told me, like, I paid 2 months, I was like, okay, that's free.
Yeah, like, 1 month is $15, basically.
$15?
For the premium set, yeah.
Huh.
It's basically what the subscription fee would have been, except it gives you more features instead of access to the full game. So let's talk about those microtransactions a little bit. So the currency that they use in-game is called Arx Cash. It maps one-to-one with Japanese yen. Because this game is not available in North America, even though Sega has been saying, oh, yeah, it's coming for like 6-7 years. I don't know. I've run out of, I don't think Sega's actually working on the game. They say they do every year. In fact, at GDC this year, they had a slide that said, here are things not to ask us questions about. And one of them was, hey guys, when is PSO2 coming? So I think they don't want to talk about it.
I guess it's the kind of stuff that when games developers are saying, oh, it's coming. It's like, oh, we always think about it, but we will never do
well, it. Well, Team Fortress 2 and Duke Nukem Forever actually did come out, and they spent, like, a really, really, really long time in development.
Team Fortress 2 was a good example.
It was actually very good.
It is. It's not what it is. But let's not talk about the other one.
No, let's not. So let's talk about those microtransactions. There are feature enablers, which enable features, obviously. My room, which lets you, you have a room inside of the game, which you can decorate with various items. If you are that kind of person, you can get a bigger room by paying a certain fee. Okay. There's My Shop, which is the most interesting one for me. My Shop actually lets you sell items you've gotten in games to other players, which is great because the in-game vendors will give you nothing for items that you get in game. Like, you get a rare item and they're like, yeah, I'll give you like 400 meseta, and you're like, yeah, but the minimum price is 1,000 on this player shop. So, client orders, which are basically the missions that you can accept in game, you have a limit of 20 normally. Now you can expand that to, I believe, 60 or 80, which is very, very useful if you want to level up fast. Additional storage.
The classic.
Very useful as well. There's the premium set, which is what I paid for, which is a month of the most commonly desired features. They pack them all into one micropayment. You can pay $15, and there you go. You've got the most commonly requested features. You've got boost items. Boost items will increase the frequency of rare drops. They will help you gain EXP or money faster. And you can also pay for boosts in specific statistics if you're that kind of person. And it also adds scape dolls, which are these very interesting items you can use to revive yourself in-game. Because if you're playing by yourself and you die, you have to, in many cases, you have to start the mission all over again from scratch. So if you have a scape doll, you can revive yourself. If you're playing with friends, your friends can revive you, and there's no problem there.
And I'm sure the scape dolls are the most expensive items.
Actually, I don't think they are. I think you can get
surprising.
Like... there are also... Actually, never mind. I'm mixing it up with another thing.
So I was right.
So let's talk about the big monetizer. The way that they make all their money is with this thing called AC Scratch. And you can probably guess from the name what it is.
Scratch lottery ticket! Woo!
Yay! And there are two kinds of Scratch lottery tickets. Of course, this is just like a rebranded gacha. Don't be surprised. There's AC Scratch for 200 yen, which is... you get basically this pool of items which can only be obtained via AC Scratch, and you get one of those random items. Among those items, there are costume parts, because in PSO2, what is great about that game is what you look like from the outside has nothing to do with the gear you have equipped. So if you want to look like a specific, like sometimes there are anime tie-ups where you can buy a costume which looks exactly like your favorite character in an anime, you can actually roll those in AC Scratch. However, there are items in the AC Scratch that are not costume parts, and wouldn't it be great if you could just pay a little bit more and only get costume parts? Well, you can do exactly that. It's called AC Scratch Gold, and it's $5 per costume part. And of course, it's a random costume part. You can't choose which one it is. And scratch items are regularly rotated. I believe it's every week or every 2 weeks. So you have 1 week to get it, and then that is how many there are going to be in the game economy until the next time it comes back, which might be never.
And what's happening when you get two items of the same genre? Like two costume of that kind?
Oh, well, there's nothing except that it would match, obviously. Like, you can get a... It's just like, you want to get like the...
Like, there's no combo they can do if you have two costume of that.
And... No, that's illegal. That's Kampugecha, which we talked about earlier, which is illegal in Japan now. They used to have that, though. Thanks, Sega. And I want to contrast a little bit with Destiny, because I am playing a lot of Destiny these days. And Destiny is basically the same game, except it's a first-person shooter.
Wait a sec. I'm sure you're speaking about Destiny right now to speak about the PS4.
No.
Yes.
No, this has nothing to do with the PS4. This has everything to do about Destiny, which is the same game as Phantasy Star Online 2, except it's a first-person shooter. This was discussed to a certain degree on the 8-4 Play podcast, which you can find a link to in the show notes. Destiny had a $500 million budget, which is insane. That is twice what GTA 5 had.
I didn't remember that GTA had a big budget like that.
Yeah, GTA is pretty much like one of the biggest budget games.
Yeah, I remember that, but I didn't remember the scale of it. And I, like, what the? Oh my god, okay.
Yeah. And last week for Christmas, there was an update on the Bungie site where they reported that they have 13 million players across all four consoles Destiny is available on, which, if you do the math, for the $60 for the game and the $13, they made back their $500 million. However, I paid $60 for the game. I am getting a ton of value out of the game. And I also paid for the expansion, which is $20. There are going to be two expansions. So that means total per player, they have a maximum potential of $100. And that seems really, really, really low, especially when you consider the amount of players they have. If they had add-ons like PSO2, they could make a lot more money, I would believe. And yeah, if it was free to play, there would be a lot of people who would never pay for the free, who would play for free. And never pay for microtransactions. But I'm pretty sure that, like, people on Twitch who make their living streaming Destiny, they would pay for more item storage, because 20 item slots in the PC is not enough, seriously. And one of the other things is, if you've been following Destiny and the reaction to Destiny, like, it was hyped, like, a lot because of the $500 million budget, obviously. But it was hyped, like, to insane degrees. And when people got it, they were very, very disappointed at the amount of content they got. Especially when compared to other $60 games. If it had been free-to-play, those complaints would have gone away because they would have gotten it for free. And then they would only be paying for the add-ons that they would be requesting. And then they would get, like, they would understand the value of the money they're paying, as opposed to, like, I paid $60 for a game and it's a 3-hour story.
Yeah, but bear with me for a sec, and I'm sure that if they were doing a free-to-play game, they would have retained that fact about that game. They would say, like, oh, that's the best game ever, and blah, 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 and when it got released, and say, oh, guys, gals, that's a free-to-play game.
Yeah, but I feel like the...
And I'm sure people will have been complaining.
Yeah, they would have complained, certainly, but I don't think, like every problem about Destiny, well, not every problem, 95% of the problems that Destiny has are because of the hype.
Yeah, but you can apply the hype problem to another game that I played recently, which is Watch Dogs.
Yeah.
Okay, for a sec, we know that it's a Ubisoft game, and we know about the quality of Ubisoft game in general, except that, if we put that aside, that game would... was hyped so much. Like, every year at every game, video game trade show, yeah. conference, whatever, they were speaking about it. They were showing a new demo, and it seemed so awesome. And then you start playing them, and after an hour or two, you realize that it was the same fucking shit for 25 hours.
Yeah. But, like, I don't know. The thing about... I really like Destiny, so I'm sad when I see, like, 6 out of 10 reviews. But at the same time, I realize that Phantasy Star would probably have gotten, like, the same reviews, because there are some people who just don't like that kind of game where it's an MMORPG, and people... don't like MMORPGs that much.
You're right. You're right. Never loved them. Never. I have the same reaction every time somebody tells me they play WoW. I'm like, what? Why are you playing that game? Not that game in general, but like the concept of playing MMOs is kind of still strange to me, even if WoW is nearly 10 years old or even more.
Yeah, but the problem, the thing with Destiny is its weakness, which is it doesn't have a lot of content, which everybody repeats all the time, is also its strength. It takes like no time to beat it and to get to level 20 and to get to the fun part of the game, which it all happens when you're done the main part of the game. So like, for me, it's a good thing that it doesn't have a lot of content. But the problem is, like, you have Bungie going to the PlayStation press conference at E3 and saying, we're going to have like lore in our thing that competes with Lord of the Rings. And then you're like, what? Lord of the Rings universe is huge. How are you going to do that? And then they're like, $500 million budget. And then you get the game and you're like, I don't care about story in games. So I want to skip all the cutscenes. There's no skippable cutscenes. That's my problem. But the problem that people who care about the cutscenes say is, well, there's no story content in this game. And that is also not entirely true. If you want the story content of the game, you have to go read it on Bungie's website.
Eh? What?
Yeah, so there are cutscenes in the game.
Understand that. But,
if you want to understand anything in the cutscenes, you have to go read the Grimoire cards, which you unlock in the game, which are cards that explain the story, but they're only readable on the website. They're not readable in-game. So no one reads them, and then they say Destiny has no story.
Why you would do that? Why you would go to the website when you're playing a fucking video game?
I don't know how Bungie works, dude.
Yeah.
So yeah, I didn't mean to diverge into the Destiny podcast for a sec, but let's talk about some other free-to-play games in a little less detail. Let's start with Monster Strike. Monster Strike is the new hotness. It's coming straight out of Japan. It saved Mixi, which is the Japanese Facebook, basically. They got destroyed basically over the last 5 to 10 years because nobody cares about it anymore. And then they made this game called Monster Strike, and now they're saved. And you can go read a New York Times article that it's like, Mixi is saved because of Monster Strike.
But it was an American company?
No, Mixi is Japanese.
Oh.
The way to explain it is it's Puzzle and Dragons plus Angry Birds.
What?
Yeah.
How can you mix?
So instead of playing a Bejeweled clone, you're playing basically like this Angry Birds game where you slingshot enemies, you slingshot your characters into enemy characters, and those enemy characters have a weak point which you can hit if you slingshot correctly, and your character stats impact how much damage you make on the enemy characters and all that stuff.
And if you hit the weak point and all that stuff.
Yeah. So that's really cool. The game mechanics are not entirely original because there's a game that one of my friends plays, which is called Uchihime, which does exactly the same thing and has existed for much longer. But, there is an innovative feature in Monster Strike, which is co-op multiplayer.
But you know what?
Yeah.
When we spoke about our free-to-play game earlier, the Yo-One with colors, we forgot to include some...
Flappy Bird.
Yeah, some Flappy Bird, Angry Bird, yeah, whatever.
Flappy Yo and Dragons.
Exactly.
It's going to sell billions.
Exactly.
Yeah, maybe Flappy Yo and Dragons should be our title. So yeah, co-op multiplayer in Monster Strike. So what's interesting about this is normally you're playing by yourself. You have like this friend character, which is not actually your friend. It's just your character, one of your character's cards participates in whatever battle you play that's in Puzzle and Dragons. In Monster Strike, what's interesting is, of course, you can play with friends. They can be friends that are close, near to you, because there's nearby friends which uses the GPS to find them, and you can play with them. Or you can play with friends that you've invited from across the internet. And what's interesting about that is if you have a 4-player party, only the host of the game loses stamina. So if you rotate your characters, you can play indefinitely for free.
Oh, because it will use each player's stamina. Yes. And then you rotate. And oh, that's nice.
The time it takes to rotate, you've regenerated and you can keep going. Oh, that's nice. Which is great, which means that lots of big gaming communities on the internet have large Facebook groups and line groups, which consist entirely of Monster Strike co-op invites so that people can keep playing for free all day long. Which is great. Next up, Terra Battle. Terra Battle is notable because it's a game by the creator of Final Fantasy, Hironobu Sakaguchi. And it's also very worrisome because there's no reason to pay for it ever. Like, the production values are insane. There are very impressive people working on this game. I have no idea how they're getting paid because there is no reason to pay for anything in this game.
I guess they have fans that only paid for it. They pay for the game.
Maybe.
The, game.
The other rumor is they are working on a player versus player section of the game where you would need much, much higher tier characters than the ones you get in the story mode, which could possibly be an avenue for paid content. But it's unclear right now with the game that I have in my hands why anyone would have to pay for it, because they give you so much free stuff that there's no reason to. Next, let's talk about Nintendo, because Nintendo sort of looks like they might be screwed. Satoru Iwata, which runs Nintendo, has commented in the past about how free-to-play is very much hurting their hardware business, which is not a good thing, because Nintendo sort of sells hardware.
Yeah, but if... funny enough, in the recent one, I wouldn't say that Nintendo is still screwed.
The Wii U is doing a nice recovery right now.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think it's selling huge numbers, but it's doing well with Nintendo fans. And that's probably all they want.
It is. And, like, Tony has the Wii U, and the only games that I play on it is Mario Kart 8.
And it's really good. It's Mario Kart great?
I wouldn't go that far. The problem I have with it is gimmicks. Like, the last Mario Kart game that I love, like, and I would say it's great and awesome, is the one on this Nintendo 64. Because it was Kart.
I have it. You want to play later? It's right there.
Yeah, but I do have it too. And it was Kart. You choose the power of the engine. And that's it. And you have items. Obviously you have items. Yeah. But it's...
I'm partial to the GameCube version. GameCube version is my favorite.
It's the Double Dash one?
Double Dash,
yeah. Yeah, I never loved that one.
I really like that one. And Mario Kart 8 is... really good for me.
Yeah, but, and let's not talk about the Wii version. Because the Wii version was...
I've never played it, actually.
I played it a little bit, but...
I don't know anyone with the Wii, except my grandma.
Yeah, I played it, and the biggest problem is, like, most people only add the Wii remote.
Yeah.
So you had to do, like, the dance with that. Oh, that sucks.
Couldn't you just use the D-pad on it? Because I would rather do that than
no,
wave
I think
the Wii.
What you had to do is you had to plug in the nunchuck. Because on the Mario Kart 8, you can do that. You plug in the nunchuck and you use the joystick.
That sounds terrible.
Oh, it's not that bad. It's better than doing the motion one.
Yeah, but I'd still rather use the D-pad on the Wiimote. Anyway, let's talk about Nintendo's experiments in free-to-play, because they have actually experimented with free-to-play in the past couple years, and it's surprising. The first of them is not actually a Nintendo game. It's a Square Enix game on a Nintendo platform, and it's Bravely Default, which is widely regarded as one of the best JRPGs on the 3DS, maybe even of the last decade or so. I haven't played it entirely. I've played the demo, and I got beaten on my first random encounter, and then I deleted it right away.
Without, like, I haven't played that game, but I heard a lot about most of the JRPGs on the 3DS. But is that the one that you need to draw the dungeon maps?
No, that's Etrian Odyssey. Okay. So Bravely Default, there is a free-to-play version of this game in Japan. I have it on my 3DS. I haven't played it yet.
Oh, it's only in Japan?
It's only in Japan.
Oh, that's bad.
It's called Bravely Default Tappuri Muryo Asoberuban, which means you play a lot for free. that's literally what it is. And what's strange is, it oddly enough, it cuts off right before the most controversial part of the game, which, if you've played it, you know what it is. If you've read spoiler reviews of it, you know what it is. If you don't, maybe just play the part before the free-to-play wall comes up, because then the game sort of gets worse.
In As you all know, listeners, from the last segment about Phoenix Wright, we don't have any spoiler horn, so we won't speak about it.
No, but if you do want to read about it, there is an article with a spoiler mention in the show notes.
Oh, you did that? Oh,
yes, I did. Wow. There's a nice bold spoilers.
Yeah. So what did you think? Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. So that's available. That's interesting, except you have no reason to pay for it because you don't want to play the second half of the game, probably, unless you actually really care about the ending of the game.
Okay.
Next up, the Dempamen Free. Have you heard of the Dempamen before?
Nope.
Okay. Well, it's a download.
Yet another DRPG?
Sort of, yeah. It's a downloadable 3DS title that is only downloadable. And they had three games in that series, and then they decided to actually just try and making it free-to-play. So they tweaked the entire game so that now it uses stamina and dungeon structure, sort of like Puzzle and Dragons. And I haven't played it, but it looks like it works like the usual game. I guess it means that there's no real ending to the game, though, because those kinds of games don't really ever end. Free-to-play games don't, usually. So that's interesting. Next up, fan favorite, Rusty's Real Deal Baseball. Have you heard of this? Because you should have if you haven't.
No, but is it a free-to-play baseball game?
It's half free-to-play. So, Rusty's Real Deal Baseball, the story is really, really interesting because it's really weird, and it was like the first Nintendo free-to-play title. It's a baseball game, but it's not like you don't play baseball in it. You play 10 mini games that are based around baseball. If it gives you any hint to what kind of game it is, it's made by the people who made the WarioWare series, which were like 5-second mini games that you played rapidly in a row.
Oh, okay.
So it's that kind of mini game, but extended to a longer length. And there are 10 of them. You can buy them individually. And what's interesting is you buy them in this fictional sports goods shop, which is run by the guy Rusty. And he's having a hard time. He's divorced and everything. And he's having a tough financial time, and he should really be making a lot of money. But he likes you, so you can negotiate with him with the prices. And you can actually bring down the prices of the games as you play.
Oh, my.
And as you become a loyal customer.
That's awesome.
Which is insane. But if you feel bad for him, you can also jack up the price of the games if you want and say, actually, Rusty, I feel bad for you. You're divorced. I'm.
Oh.
It's not funny. I'm going to give you a bunch of money for this game that really shouldn't really cost that much.
You're paying real money for that? Or?
You're paying real money. And he is making it very clear in the narrative of the story that you are paying real cash for this. But you can actually like give him like $20 if you want, I guess.
But that's awesome. That's really awesome.
So that was actually very interesting because it was like their first free-to-play experiment, and it was at least narratively interesting from the story perspective. People played it because they were curious about this weird story, and I think it did pretty well. Next up is something brand new that came out a couple of weeks ago, which is Collectible Badge Center. Have you heard about this? No. Okay. So...
Honestly, for a sec, do you have any North American games here?
Puzzle and Dragons is out in North America.
No, I'm speaking about in the Nintendo eShop experiment.
Rusty's Real Deal Baseball is out here.
Oh.
And I think maybe Dempamen Free. I'm not sure. I don't have a US 3DS, so I can't check.
Oh, we can't check. I have my 3DS with me.
Collectible Badge Center. You know that the 3DS's theme is now, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So you can get like a Mario theme and have like a Mario level behind you. Well, wouldn't it be nice if you could customize the Mario level or change the icons of your 3DS things? Well, Collectible Badge Center is a crane game taken out of an arcade, put into your 3DS, and you can actually get badges out of the crane and then put them on your 3DS home screen and customize your home screen out of it. Which basically means you're paying... Well, you start off with 5 free tries, and then if you want more free tries, you can pay 90 yen for 5 more tries, and you can basically throw money away trying to customize your 3DS home screen randomly. Thanks, Nintendo. And
that's a brilliant way to make money from Nintendo.
It's a brilliant way. It's also very weird because like Nintendo fans that usually hate on free-to-play stuff are suddenly, this is genius! And now they're throwing all their money in the crane
game. It's not even a game. It's just a way to make you spend tons of money on...
It's a great way to make up for the money they're not making by not selling Wii U's.
Maybe they should do that on the Wii U's.
Maybe they should. Yeah. So that's about it for my honorable mentions. I do want to state that free-to-play games are not all perfect. Like, I am trying to make people accepting of the free-to-play model, or at least willing to give them a chance, because like I said at the top of the show, it's very, very hard to look from the outside of a game and judge if it's a good game with good intentions or if it's just trying to get you to spend as much money as much as possible. Yes, it's a business. You sort of have to try and convince people to give you money, but it doesn't have to be all of the money. The other day I was reading a thing like, I spent $400 on a PS4. And then the other guy was like, $400? I spent that in 30 seconds in a free-to-play game. Like,
oh my God. Oh.
Yeah.
I would only add something about the free-to-play games and like the business model they use is like, we talked a little bit about Gran Turismo, and we spoke a little bit about...
Yeah, that was before the show, sort of.
Yeah, before the show, we mentioned it during the show, but, like, the free-to-play business models, some part of those business models are brought to normal games.
Yes.
In the microtransaction stuff. And
EA is notorious for them.
Yeah, but EA is notoriously...
douchey.
Douchey, yeah. The right word is douchey for that. But... on GT6, on Gran Turismo 6, they are doing it in a good way. And what they are doing is, like, if you want to enjoy the game, enjoy the game, and you'll be able to buy the car you want. If you want to have the car right now, just buy in-game credit, and that's it.
Right.
There's
You can exchange real money for in-game money, basically.
Exactly. But there's no gimmick. Like, there's no way to make you progress faster in the game, I would say. But not to progress faster, but, like, there was no taxes on in-game cars when they brought that.
Right, the prices weren't increased in a significant way, unlike Forza, which I also mentioned earlier.
Yeah,
where there is a Kotaku article you can go look up where they actually like do the math to see how much it costs to buy cars if you take into consideration the time it takes to get money versus how much it takes to spend for it. And surprise, surprise, it's cheaper to buy it in real money. Because otherwise you're going to be spending all your life playing Forza, and you probably won't care about the car once you're done.
Yeah, exactly. And when it costs you as much as a brand new car to get the virtual car, there's a problem.
So I do want to end by just saying there is a great article by Tim Rogers. You may know Tim Rogers because he runs Action Button Entertainment, which is a game developer, which is working on Video Ball, which I am greatly looking forward to. And he actually used to work at Zynga, I believe, for some amount of time. And he wrote an article about what goes on in the meeting rooms for free-to-play games, free-to-play game developers. And I'm not sure. It's probably about Zynga, though. It's not nice. It's really not nice. It's either Zynga or EA.
Oh, my.
And I don't know. This is going to sound really, really biased, but I think that Asian companies do a better job of handling the ethical part of free-to-play, because they've actually had this for much, much longer, because they've had cell phone games on flip phones for like ages before us. So they've worked out all the kinks in the system, whereas here in the West, we're like new to this. The iPhone is like the first thing that really started.
Yeah, without generalizing, we can say that right now we have examples of companies doing the right thing with free-to-play.
There's a reason I didn't really mention any Western companies, and the reason is that I couldn't really find any respectable Western free-to-play games. There's Crossy Road.
Yeah.
But Crossy Road had the same criticism I had for Terra Battle, where for many people it became very, very unclear when they needed to spend money. Like, why should I spend any money on this game?
I guess
the difference is that they had ads, and none of these games have ads of any kind.
Yeah, and honestly, the only reason I would spend money in Crossroad is just to get new character faster.
Yeah.
That's the only reason.
So you can find that article. It's called Who Kills Video Games by Tim Rogers in the show notes. And that, surprisingly, is all I had to say. Wait, what? Only an hour and 22 minutes. I'm surprised.
You went pretty fast on that.
I thought it was going to be like a 2-hour show.
No. you went pretty fast. And before we leave, since you have a long list of show notes,
we should probably tell people where to find them.
Exactly.
Okay, so you can find our show notes at limitlesspossibility.net/6.
Yes, six.
Six. Yeah, because it's episode 6.
And where people can find you on the internet.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter. I'm at Sakurina. That's S-A-K-U-R-I-N-A. You are?
At Lukonosh, L-U-C-O-N-O-C-H-E.
The show is on Twitter as well, at Limipo_podcast. That's L-I-M-I-P-O underscore podcast. And we have a general website where you can find our older episodes and all that stuff at limitlesspossibility.net.
And I just want to mention before we leave that the next episode will be the last episode for a couple of weeks because our friend Yannick is going to travel to Japan.
Yeah, I'm going to be gone for a month and a half, so
we might do something special during his travel to Japan. We might be able to
Depending how much time I have free on the weekends.
So we'll keep you posted on that. And that's it for today.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.